This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to Pacific Beat. My name is Jordan Fennell. Today on the show, Ishmael Tarama has been voted in as Bougainville's new president. And coming up shortly, you'll hear about his journey to the top job and what his main priorities will be moving forward. And in Vanuatu, cervical cancer is the second highest killer of women.
We have a very small population and the numbers we're seeing is actually ridiculous.
In around half an hour, you'll hear about the plans that are underway there and in several Pacific countries for major vaccination drives aimed at protecting an entire generation of women. Also coming up, for the past 5 years, the Port Moresby Nature Park in PNG has been rehabilitating the endangered pig-nosed turtle. And then this year, while the country was in the middle of a coronavirus lockdown, they undertook a mission to release them back into the wild.
The night before they announced that there was now going to be a 2-week lockdown. And so logistically trying to get permissions and then trying to get the airline to be able to fly us. Our window got down to 24 hours. And if we did not get on that plane, it was not going to happen in 2020.
Those stories and more coming up this hour.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
A former rebel army leader has been elected president of Bougainville as the region pushes for independence from Papua New Guinea. PNG's Prime Minister, James Marape, offered his congratulations, saying the win was conclusive and that he offered his support to deliver on his commitments to Bougainville. The United Nations in PNG also offered their congratulations to the people of Bougainville, saying that the UN remains committed to work with Ishmael Tarama and to continue to support the implementation of the Bougainville Peace Agreement. It's thought up to 20,000 people died in a civil war in the region in the 80s and 90s before a peace deal and a commitment to hold a referendum brought an end to the violence. Last year, the referendum was held and Bougainvillians voted overwhelmingly to seek independence from PNG, with 98% in favour. The people returned to the polls last month to vote in a new president and regional parliament, with the final results handed down yesterday. PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting reports.
By the Office of the Bougainville Electoral Commission and under the Bougainville Election Act, announced Ishmael Tarama as the newly elected president for the autonomous Bougainville government.
30 years ago, Ishmael Tarama was leading troops in a rebel army during a bloody conflict in Bougainville. Now he's been voted in as the region's new president.
Congratulations.
It comes at a crucial time for Bougainville as it begins negotiations with Papua New Guinea about possible independence.
I think the vision and the dream is there. We have to fulfill the dreams and the vision of why we fought.
As a commander of the Bougainville Revolutionary Army, Mr. Tarama was said to be one of the most respected leaders by the troops as they campaigned for independence from PNG. It's thought up to 20,000 people died in the conflict in the 80s and 90s. Mr. Tarama was one of the signatories on a peace agreement that brought an end to the war. That agreement promised a referendum on independence. Last year, the vote was held and almost 98% voted in favour. As the referendum was non-binding, Mr. Tarama will now have the responsibility of leading negotiations with the PNG government.
On my side, if we push hard on independence, because that is the key issue on Bougainville.
And he wants the negotiations to happen quickly. It could be tough going. Many in the PNG National Parliament don't want to see Bougainville secede.
During my campaign, I was stressing out, I have this time frame of 2 to 3 years. And the peace agreement, it states there are benchmarks that we can reach.
2 to 3 years would be seen as a relatively quick negotiation period. Do you think the National Parliament, the National Government will support moving that quickly?
Everyone has their own agenda and issues, so it's something that we can continue to discuss on the dialogue and come up with the necessary time frame.
So, ideally, from your point of view, when would you like to see Bougainville become independent, to become its own country? When do you think that could be possible?
I would like to see the national government ratifying the 98%. That is the first step that I would like to see. And secondly, after that, then we will get ourselves prepared. It will be another time frame as the national government ratifies that, the outcome. And maybe a time of 5 years, after 5 years. But that is my time frame.
The PNG government's Minister for Bougainville Affairs, Sir Puka Temu, recently told Parliament that he envisaged a meeting being held in November once Bougainville's new government was in place.
I want to say that the technical team have been meeting regularly. I've maintained communication with my counterpart in Bougainville, although they've gone through the elections.
PNG's Prime Minister James Marape has released a statement congratulating Mr. Tarama on his election and saying he looked forward to progressing consultations on the outcome of the recent referendum and securing long-term economic development and a lasting peace for the people of Bougainville. PNG has been promoting the idea of economic independence in the wake of the referendum, but that may not satisfy Ishmael Tarama or the people of Bougainville.
That was our PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting reporting there. And what are your thoughts on Ishmael Tarama being elected as Bougainville's new president? Head on over to our Facebook page at ABC Radio Australia and drop us a message. We've had this message from Renzi Duncan, a follower of Bougainville politics in Sydney, who sent Radio Australia this message about the former BRA commander's election.
There's no doubt that the election of the former Bougainville revolutionary commander Ishmael Tarama is going to be a significant change in direction for Bougainville. He was swept to power on an anti-corruption platform, and that's clearly resonated with a large majority of voters across all the length and breadth of Bougainville. I really think people believe he's a doer and not just a talker, and that he's actually earned his stripes. I mean, we're talking about a man who was shot trying to get to one of the first peace meetings during the Bougainville conflict. So he has nothing to prove about how genuine he is. And I think people clearly respect him.
Renzi Duncan letting us know his opinion there. What do you think? Get in touch on Facebook or Twitter. Just search ABC Radio Australia.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
One person who's seen Mr. Tarama's evolution from feared guerrilla fighter to peacemaker to president-elect is photojournalist Ben Behane. He believes Bougainvillians voted for Mr. Tarama because he won't back down in negotiations with the PNG government over implementing last year's overwhelming vote for independence. Mr. Behane first met the island's new president in the early 1990s while reporting on the decade-long civil war.
I got picked up by him when I was trekking up to see Francis Ona, and he turned up in a four-wheel drive running on pure coconut oil. So it was the first time I realised that you can run any diesel engine on pure coconut oil. He had a reputation during the war as a pretty hardcore BRA leader and guerrilla commander. In fact, he was sometimes called Rambo because he led a special forces group of BRAs known as the Rambo Force. So he was always considered a very strong kind of guerrilla leader, and obviously very strong on the push for independence. Then, of course, the peace process unfolded, and even though he did have a very strong reputation for being a hardcore BRA, he did follow the peace process. He signed up, along with Sam Kawona and the others, to follow the peace process, and he's engaged with that ever since.
Given what you've just said, how would you describe the qualities he'll bring to being Bougainville's new president?
I think he'll work with a very consensual approach, in the sense that he's used to dealing with other commanders and rank and file. I think he'll want to reassure Bougainvillians that their independence plans are on track, and that comes after 97.7% voted for independence last year. You know, he's a fairly softly spoken man, despite his hard kind of history. I think he will draw on others around him to try and create a, a cabinet that will move Bougainville forward, both in terms of political autonomy and also economic autonomy. Since the war ended, he's been a bit of a businessman around town, so he's obviously keen to see business proceed in Bougainville. I think it may also signal that after many years of President John Momus and the Bougainville Autonomous Government, very much based on Booker and in North Bougainville, he may represent a new kind of push for central Bougainville and to get the economy going in sort of central and south Bougainville.
During last year's referendum, while most of the media was up in Booker, you spent some time with Ismail Tarama in Arawa. Did he mention sort of what his priorities would be?
He said he wasn't planning to run for president, but he decided to, partly because he was concerned whether PNG would recognise the outcome of the referendum, but also he was concerned about potentially other external players. And I think in this regard, he was thinking of China and wanted to very much make any independent Bougainville stand on its own feet and not be reliant on external powers.
I remember doing a story ahead of the election, you know, asking people what the big issues, and clearly it's realising the independence vote. And one person described that holding the vote was really the easy part, and that the hard part is now going to be negotiating with PNG, given that it's got to be approved by the PNG Parliament. Do you think he has the skills, the fortitude to do that?
I think whatever happens, the Bougainville people have voted him. And I think they see him as an insurance policy in some ways. They know that with Ismail in charge, that he will be uncompromising in the push for independence. I think he's softened, you know, since the war. He was very softly spoken when I last chatted to him on the sidelines of the referendum. He was very keen to continue the peace process and to follow the guidance inherent in that and follow the process. Ultimately, yes, it does have to be ratified and by the PNG Parliament, and that's not a given. And maybe that's partly why the Bougainville people have really put their trust in him to make sure that he will hold the line on that and not let PNG kind of let that opportunity slip.
What do you think his election to presidency means for Bougainville's relations, firstly with PNG and secondly with Australia?
I guess you could say it puts both PNG and Australia on notice in the sense that the Bougainville people have elected a strong man who's hardcore for independence. That will bring a certain toughness potentially to the negotiation, or at least a sense that Bougainville will not compromise on that front. So PNG and Australia will have to sort of face that. But the good thing is Ismail showed that he was ready to engage the peace process. He followed the peace process. And last year, there was a very significant reconciliation ceremony conducted between the Papua New Guinea Defence Force and the Bougainville Revolutionary Army and also the Bougainville Resistance Force, which had been pro-PNG during the war. And many of the former commanders on both sides met, hugged, embraced, broke spears and bows and arrows, as is custom. So I think there's been a considerable movement for peace and reconciliation between former militants on all sides, including the Papua New Guinea Defence Force. And so that's a good positive sign, I think, that these issues can be resolved in Melanesian custom.
Photojournalist Ben Behane speaking there to reporter Liam Fox.
ABC Australia iView is a free video streaming service from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation for users around the world. The ABC Australia iView app is available for download on iOS and Android devices. ABC Australia iView has content that will keep you in touch with what is happening in Australia.
We simply want to say to you, Australia, thank you. Keep doing it. You're saving lives and you're saving livelihoods.
As well as comedy, entertainment, education and English language learning content. You can also stream the ABC News Channel live through your device using this app. So to watch great ABC programs like Four Corners Foreign Correspondent and Gardening Australia, download the ABC Australia iView app now.
Let's have some music. This is Loon Lake with Cherry Lips.
He won't even notice that you just put two pills down. Except for when you cuddle him or the way you jump around. He calls you by your last name, but he thinks it is your first. Everyone's in love with him, but you're just feeling worse. But it's almost nighttime, and you know that's the right time to dance. Ooh, put your cherry on your lips and shake those sexy hips, tonight's a chance.
That was Loon Lake with Cherry Lips.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
My name's Jordan Fennon. That's right, you're with me here on Pacific Beat. Brisbane man Talalele Paunga is facing an extradition hearing in the city's Magistrates Court this week over allegations that he plotted to kill the Prime Minister of Samoa, Tuilepa Salele Malielenga-Oli. The extradition request from Samoa was made back in August, and Mr. Paunga was taken into custody by Australia Police and has been on remand now for almost 5 weeks at the Arthur Gorrie Correctional Centre. The hearing, which started on Monday, was scheduled to take only 30 minutes, but it's now been adjourned until tomorrow, with Mr. Paunga's lawyers arguing that his detention is unlawful. Talia Olatia has been speaking to Brisbane Times reporter Lucy Stone, who is covering the extradition hearing.
This came in on Friday last week. An extradition warrant was put before the magistrates' court then. Samoa requested that this extradition warrant be put through. And it was sort of, it dragged on over the past few days, and we still don't have a result. But basically, Mr. Paunga is still in detention, and we'll have part of a decision on it on Friday afternoon. And then the extradition warrant hearings will probably continue in November.
What's making it take so long? Like, what are his lawyers are saying, and what are Samoa's lawyers saying as well?
Well, his lawyers have been putting forward a lot of complicated arguments based on their interpretations of particular laws. So they've taken the magistrate through the Privacy Act, initially arguing that the court should be closed because Mr. Paunga's privacy needed to be respected. That wasn't successful. They've also arguing on grounds both in the Extradition Act and the Human Rights Act, the Queensland Human Rights Act, which is quite new. And they're taking the magistrate through those two acts in particular, particularly trying to argue that Mr. Paunga is being unlawfully detained because he was not physically brought before a magistrate when he was first arrested on August 20. They're basing that argument on the legislation saying a person must be brought before a magistrate as soon as practical. When the arrest first took place, Mr. Paunga was represented in the magistrate's court by a solicitor, but his lawyers have been arguing quite vigorously that that doesn't mean he himself was there and he has therefore been unlawfully detained. So that's been the bulk of the arguments for the past 2 days, and we're likely to hear a decision by Magistrate Belinda Merrin on that on Friday afternoon, and then the extradition hearing itself will continue.
So we're not even talking about the extradition right now. It's just the process that Mr. Paunga has seen so far in terms of being remanded for 5 weeks in detention. What is that going to achieve when it comes to the extradition hearing? Are they hoping that it all just gets thrown out because of due process?
Well, it's a good question. I'm not entirely sure where they're going with it, other than their primary goal being to get him out of detention and back into his home while the extradition warrant continues. They're arguing that he's not a flight risk because he knew that this extradition was a likely chance. They're arguing that he shouldn't be detained, and Samoa's lawyers are opposing all of that quite vigorously, saying, well, no, everything has gone according to legal principles in Australia, and that Australia has an obligation under international law to maintain what they say is the law.
It's alleged that Mr. Paunga was involved in a plot to kill the Samoan Prime Minister, Tuilepa Salele Malielenga-Oi. Do we have any more idea of what those allegations against him are about?
Look, they haven't been aired in this magistrates' court. So it's been very much essentially limited to what was being reported in Samoan media. And then essentially supporters of Mr. Palga, who've been in court for the past few days, said that they are concerned that this extradition hearing is more politically motivated. So Mr. Palga, back in November 2018, he was charged by Queensland Police after he threw a pig's head at the Samoan Prime Minister in Logan, south of Brisbane. Those charges were dropped. And the particular organisation, not-for-profit organisation, the Samoan Solidarity International Group, have been supporting him. They said they weren't part of that original protest in November 2018, but they're concerned that his extradition request and the following consequences of that are politically motivated against Mr. Palga for being a political activist. We're still in the question of whether or not he should be detained in Arthur Gurie Correctional Centre, which is just south of Brisbane. So that's what we'll essentially be hearing about on Friday. My understanding is then that we will probably see more days in court to discuss the actual extradition.
That's Brisbane Times reporter Lucy Stone, and she was speaking there to Talia Olatia. Now it's time to find out all the latest news updates from around the region. And to do that, I'm joined by Richard Hewitt. Good morning, Richard.
Morning, Jordan.
Richard, let's start with some health news from Papua New Guinea, which is actually not COVID-19 related.
Not only that, it's good news as well, with Port Moresby General Hospital receiving a consignment of surgical equipment from China and a pledge from China to send another team of consultants and support staff to assist to PNG medical workers. MTV reporting that the equipment is worth more than 170,000 kina, that's around 70,000 Australian dollars, and it's apparently been in the country for a little while, but the handover has been delayed by the pandemic. Had to be a mention there somewhere, didn't there? This is all part of the catchily entitled Cooperation Agreement on the second round of partnership hospital assistance, which the PNG government signed with China in May last year. And as part of that deal, a Chinese medical team will be dispatched, we're told, to PNG every 2 years.
Well, good news indeed. But turning to COVID-19 news, it has been quiet in PNG so far this week. So what's the latest?
Well, I think it's a case of the numbers are still edging upwards, but the information perhaps is a little slow to emerge from the National Control Centre. However, they did release a bulletin late last night confirming 3 more coronavirus cases in Port Moresby, 2 men aged 25 and 50, and a pregnant woman who's just 21. All 3 are in isolation and contact tracing has begun. And those cases bring the total number in PNG to 531, with 7 deaths, while 509 of the patients that have proved positive have recovered so far. Elsewhere, the numbers continue to rise in the US territory of Guam, with the latest round of 423 tests yielding 45 positive results and taking the total number of confirmed cases to 2,235.
Now turning to Samoa, where controversial moves to amend the country's Electoral Act have been passed at last.
Yeah, it's taken a while and the controversy has been intense at times, but the amendments that have been voted through may go some way to taking the heat out of the situation. The key elements have been to change the wording of the Act, which previously appeared to essentially prevent people living in redrawn constituencies from actually putting themselves forward as candidates, should they choose to do so, in next year's general election. And a second important matter that's been cleared up is contained in an amendment that will allow candidates to seek a judicial review of decisions made by the Electoral Commission, which we think would be pretty fundamental in a democratic election. So quite what wasn't there in the first place, I'm not too sure.
Yeah, interesting. And definitely leading up to that general election in April 2021 next year in Samoa. Interesting to see how that will all play out. But Richard, now earlier in the year, Pacific Beat spoke to Fijian lawyer Anna Tuikete when she became the woman counsel from the Pacific to join the global roster working for the International Criminal Court in The Hague. And already it appears she's having quite an impact.
Yeah, that's true, because if you take a trip to the ICC's website, you'll find that Ms. Tuikete's name has now been added to the membership of the Court's Defence Committee. Now, this is an important body which is tasked with advising the ICC's Executive Council and the General Assembly on all matters relating to a suspect's defence. And, of course, being the International Criminal Court, often these are very high-profile suspects. And Tuikete's appointment has come as a surprise to her, and she's been quoted as saying that people normally elected to the committee are seasoned professionals professionals with a wealth of expertise at the ICC. However, she views her appointment as an opportunity for Pacific Islanders, and clearly for Fijians in particular, to be part of what she describes as an international organisation and prove that the right talent. Let me do that again. To be part of an international organisation and prove the right kind of talent exists in the region. So, yeah, she's really flying the flag for Fijian expertise, for Pacific expertise, and, of course, for females as well. The first female from the Pacific to sit on the ICC. One male back in about 15 years ago, I think, is the only other representative we've had.
Yeah, wow. And like you said, a great example of, yeah, woman in power leading the way for Pacific Islander females. It's excellent. Richard, thank you so much for those updates.
No problem.
Hi, I'm Matt from Pacific Playtime. Pacific Playtime is a show for kids and their grown-ups on ABC Radio Australia. It's all about listening, learning and having fun. We'll learn new things and discover the world around us.
Have you ever noticed that people wear shoes, but other animals don't really wear shoes? Have you ever seen an elephant wearing shoes?
No.
We'll even learn some new words.
The word I want to teach you today is nagula. Can you say nagula?
Nagula. Nagula. Nagula.
Nagula means salt water, of the ocean or sea.
Join me each Saturday morning at 7:30 and Sunday morning at 5:30 PNG time, only on ABC Radio Australia.
My name's Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. Coming up soon, you're going to hear about how cervical cancer is one of the biggest killers of women in Vanuatu, but also how there is now a plans underway for a push towards a large vaccination program to save an entire generation of women. But first, let's have some music. This is Boy and Bear with Feeding Line. Boy and Bear there with their song, Feeding Line.
Island Music brings you the finest reggae from Jamaica and around the world with a spotlight on the freshest Pacifica talent.
Join me, Rick Howe, for Island Music, a two-hour journey from the foundation of Jamaican popular music from ska, rocksteady, roots, dub and dancehall, plus the freshest new releases and a spotlight on emerging talent from around the Pacific.
Every Saturday with Rick Howe from 12 till 2 p.m. PNG time on Radio Australia, across the Pacific.
My name's Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. While our focus has been on COVID, on a COVID-19 vaccine, plans are underway in several Pacific countries for major vaccination drives aimed at protecting an entire generation of women from cervical cancer. It's been a long time coming and an expensive exercise, as Marla Damati reports.
Cervical cancer is often described as a silent killer. Many women, especially in developing countries, don't know they have it until it's too late. In Vanuatu, it's the second most common cancer for women, and experts say the country has exceptionally high rates for its small population.
We have a very small population, and the numbers we're seeing is actually ridiculous.
Dr. Erilyn Tungu is a gynecologist and runs Vanuatu's cervical cancer program. She says for a long time it's been difficult to raise awareness about cervical cancer and explain to women why it's important they come in for screening.
I think it's a bit of a challenge. The cervical cancer program has been running for about more than 10 years now, and it's quite a challenge because our islands are scattered, and most of the population are actually not too well educated, and so, should I say, literate. And so everything needs to be translated into proper and culturally appropriate language.
It's often considered to be a taboo subject because the screening, which is done by a pap smear, involves a woman's vagina being swabbed. But Dr. Erilyn Tungu says that attitudes have been changing.
I think lately we've done a few public awareness. We've done it on TV and we've even gone to the papers, and our screening rate has actually really increased. And we're seeing a lot of women presenting with the cancer because I guess our screening has, increased and our pickup rate has increased as well.
But screening isn't the only way to protect women from cervical cancer, which is caused by the sexually transmitted human papillomavirus, or HPV.
The vaccine is known to be highly effective for preventing cervical cancer.
Inez Mikkelsen-Lopez is a health specialist with the Asia Development Bank and heads up its specific vaccination and immunization project. HPV vaccines only became available this century, thanks to Australian experts who developed it. Vanuatu has had previous HPV vaccination campaigns over the past decade, but Dr. Erilyn Tungu says that a 2017 pilot program has exhausted its supplies. Now more than 2 years in the making, Vanuatu is edging closer to a new cervical cancer vaccination program it plans to start next year. Dr. Len Tarivonda is the director of Vanuatu's health department and is also part of the national immunization team.
Actually, we have a big project funded by ADB, the Asian Development Bank. This has started last year, but it took some time to actually get it off the ground. This project and program of introducing three new vaccines into what we already provide, including the HPV vaccine for cervical cancer, this will still go ahead.
It's a vaccination program that comes with a hefty price tag. To help cover the cost of procuring the vaccines, Vanuatu received a $2.25 million concessional loan and also a $9 million grant from the Asia Development Bank. It will target schoolgirls aged between 9 and 14 years and will be rolled out throughout the schools across Vanuatu.
It is a school-based program. And we will be vaccinating young girls who are not yet sexually active. And these are girls in class or year 5 and year 6. And it will be throughout Vanuatu.
The ADB's Inez Mikkelsen-Lopez says that Samoa, Tonga, Tuvalu will join Vanuatu in rolling out this program.
The governments have agreed to target a coverage rate of 80% of females for the ages of 9 to 14 years for HPV vaccine.
And while no official start dates have been set yet, this week the Vanuatu government appointed new staff who will help assist with the vaccine rollout. Here's Dr. Tarivonda again.
This week they've just appointed the additional staff that will be working with the national EPI program in Port Phillip to actually roll out the introduction of the three new vaccines. So we really look forward to seeing a lot of momentum gathering on this, given the slow start we've had last year and even up to now.
And while gynecologist Dr. Erilyn Tungu sees the vaccination program as a very positive step in the fight against cervical cancer for future generations, she emphasizes that it's not the answer for older women who have not been vaccinated.
I think it's really important, not only to get the vaccine, but also to do the screening, because, you can't just do vaccination and, get everybody cured from it. So the vaccination would be able to cater for the 9 to 15 year olds in 20 years time. The population at hand is also at risk and they need screening as well. So we're hoping to get both vaccine and as well as the HPV testing.
That was gynecologist Dr. Erilyn Tungu ending that report by Marla Damati.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Vanuatu, Solomon Islands and Samoa have all banned imports of Australian poultry because of an outbreak of avian influenza. In the Australian state of Victoria, poultry farmers are dealing with the double whammy of coronavirus and an outbreak of avian influenza. It's the worst outbreak of bird flu the state has ever seen, with hundreds of thousands of birds culled. As Jess Davis reports, the outbreak has raised concerns about the rise of free-range farming.
On this farm at Stonehaven, just over an hour west of Melbourne, Julie Coz's free-range chickens are under lockdown.
I'm really surprised at how well they're coping.
like us humans with the coronavirus. You just need to get on with it. You just need to adapt and do the right things.
6 weeks ago, Agriculture Victoria ordered all poultry in the Golden Plains Shire to be housed inside after a free-range egg farm at Lethbridge tested positive to a highly pathogenic strain of bird flu.
Well, at first my heart sunk to the ground when I found out. I mean, I pride ourselves on our birds being out every day of the year.
Bird flu is predominantly spread through wild birds coming into contact with commercial poultry flocks. Victoria's Chief Veterinary Officer, Graham Cook, says it's the first time a housing order has been implemented in Australia.
The last case was just a matter of weeks ago, and that means there's still a high level of virus in that area. When we think the time is right and it's constantly under review, we will lift that requirement.
There are now 6 farms across the state dealing with outbreaks of 3 different strains of the virus, with around 460,000 birds culled. At Bairnsdale, in the east of the state, a free-range turkey farm became infected after birds were transported from its sister farm at Lethbridge, 4.5 hours away. 10,000 birds have been culled across the 2 farms.
I cried. I did. It was devastating.
Farm manager Narelle Mollard says the process of decontamination has been long and arduous, with Agriculture Victoria on site every day for the last 6 weeks.
They had a team of contractors come in to dispose of the turkeys, the litter, the mulch, the soil, anything that a bird could have come into contact with, and it was all removed from the site.
Brian Ahmed from the Victorian Farmers Federation blames outbreaks like the one at Lethbridge on the rapid rise of large-scale free-range farming, with the worst affected company, Farm Pride, having to cull 380,000 birds alone, around a third of its flock.
This was not surprising to me. It's a numbers game. The more we put outside, the more risk there is of something like this happening. Unfortunately, to produce the volume of eggs that the supermarkets want, there need to be 20, 30, 40,000 birds in a shed.
When it gets into chickens where there is a high population density of new hosts, like intensive chicken farms, then there is a chance that the virus, if it mutates to a high pathogenic form, it becomes a serious disease and then it becomes very contagious.
Frank Wong from the CSIRO has spent the last 10 years tracking avian influenza around the world.
Then you can sort of see the problems that we've seen in Lethbridge, where lots of chickens succumb to disease virtually over the course of a few days.
But for Narelle Mollard, it's a risk worth taking.
It's opened my eyes. But if you want free-range turkeys as well, and chickens or anything like that, it's a risk that you've got to be aware of.
Jess Davis reporting there.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, coming up, you're going to hear about how the Port Moresby Nature Park in PNG, which is home to rescued and endangered animals across the country, has been battling to stay open amid coronavirus restrictions, and how, remarkably, in the middle of a lockdown, they were able to release the endangered pig-nosed turtle back into the wild. But first, let's have a bit more music. This is Bobby Alu with his song, Tangi. Bobby Alu there with his song, Tangi.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
That's right. My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. Papua New Guinea's Port Moresby Nature Park has been struggling to stay afloat and take care of its hundreds of animals during the COVID-19 pandemic. But despite this, they've forged ahead and have not only released a group of endangered pig-nosed turtles back into the wild, but have also started a project to save the frogs of PNG. I've been speaking to Michelle McGeorge, the park's chief executive, to find out more.
Pig-nosed turtles are a freshwater turtle, and they're only found on the island of New Guinea and the top part of Australia. They're now recently been reclassified as endangered species, and that's primarily due to overhunting and also to particularly in the West Papua area from poaching and trafficking for the illegal pet trade and Chinese traditional medicine. So PNG really remains the last stronghold for this species.
And how has the Port Moresby Nature Park been involved in the rehabilitation of these turtles?
5 years ago, we actually started working with the University of Canberra to do a research program. So the goal was to raise hatchlings. So we actually received 47 from the wild that were eggs. They were hatched here, and then we essentially kind of let them grow here in a safe, predator-free environment. And then last year we sent our first clutch back. They were at the size where we felt comfortable that their percentage of survival rate would be quite high, about 30%, which doesn't sound very high, but as a hatchling, they've got about a 1% chance of survival.
And you sent 15 of the 47 back into the wild last year, but then this year in July, you released the rest of them, but it was in the middle of a lockdown in Port Moresby. How did that end up playing out?
We were able to get permission from the government to complete our planned and scheduled release date for the remaining turtles. But by the end of it, I can say we're all kind of breathing a big sigh of relief, because the night before they announced that there was now going to be a 2-week lockdown. And so logistically trying to get permissions and then trying to get the airline to be able to fly us, because we were the only, you know, the curator and the wildlife manager were the only two people approved to actually fly on a plane. So it took us 2 days, and our window got down to 24 hours. And if we did not get on that plane, it was not going to happen in 2020. So it was a big relief when I got the text message to say we're boarding the plane and we're going.
Oh my goodness, that sounds extremely stressful, but also I'm so glad that there was that happy ending.
Yeah, it was feeling a bit that way, and it was like they have to go. We just knew that it was time.
So you've been able to rehabilitate and release back into the wild these endangered pig-nosed turtles, and all while dealing with the impact of coronavirus. There have been, you know, lockdowns in PNG, and now people are living under new normal rules of wearing masks and social distancing. After many months of this, how is the Port Moresby Nature Park coping?
So August, we were down 70% on visitation. So really, we were kind of recovering, actually. In June, July, we started to see the numbers creep back up. We went back to last year's numbers, but we were only, say, 20-30% down. And then just at the end of July, with the number of COVID cases and the government announcing that, yes, there is evidence of widespread community transmission, we found we dropped back down to 70%. But in order to sustain the operations, obviously, you know, ideally we need to be at 100% capacity. And so we did launch a GoFundMe campaign in June, which was the Port Moresby Nature Park Wildlife Appeal. And really what we've been trying to do is seek support globally, just to help us keep going, making sure too that, you know, we accept a lot of injured wildlife, a lot of surrendered wildlife, and where possible, we try to rehabilitate them and release them back into safe places. But if we can't rehabilitate them due to injury, we give them a forever home here at the nature park.
On that topic of the online fundraiser that you started in June, what sort of response have you seen to that so far?
Yeah, the last few weeks, it's been really great. I think, you know, we've been really trying to raise awareness about the park. And I think that, you know, if people are aware that there is actually only one of these in the country, and I think, you know, overseas, people kind of see the value of keeping us going and the important work that we're doing here. So I've been quite lucky. I think we're up to $285,000 Australian dollars. Our target was to pay for 10 months of all of our wildlife expenses, and that included the water and the electricity and security costs. So our total goal is around $430,000 Australian dollars. So I feel like we're definitely getting there. And for me, you know, it's a huge relief, because I'm not only just responsible for 550 animals, but at the end of the day, I'm responsible for 70 staff and their livelihoods. And many of my staff, I know they're supporting their entire families and their extended families.
So the Port Moresby Nature Park is really a very central part of, I guess, Port Moresby's economy, and also, as you were saying, its community as well. What have you heard from people within the community about their response to what's going on at the Port Moresby Nature Park?
The goal is for us to connect the city people, as you will, to PNG's natural biodiversity and environment. And we, you know, normally we would have picnics throughout the year, but because of, you know, numbers of group size numbers restrictions, We haven't been able to do picnics, but normally we would be the place where people would be having their weddings, their graduations and their birthday parties. And then another big area we focus on is our education programs. And normally we would educate 24,000 school children every year on natural sciences. So I think for the community to, when they've heard that we've been going through this stage, a lot of them have been taking up memberships. They might not necessarily be able to come as much, but trying to support us in what little ways that they can. Now, I think the outpouring has been lovely, and it kind of just shows how vital we are, you know, not just to Port Moresby, but also to Papua New Guinea.
And as you do continue to push forward, you know, through this and with the support of the community behind you, are there any other projects that the park is currently focusing on?
We've also been doing a lot of work on frogs. There's a fungus that's actually spread all across the world. It's called the chytrid fungus. It's decimated frog populations globally. They estimate in the last three decades up to 50% of the world's frogs have actually been killed because of this fungus that lives in the water. And for whatever reason, we don't know, but researchers have determined that PNG remains one of the last countries or land masses in the world that chytrid fungus has not arrived in. And so what the project we're trying to do here is that we would like to bed down the genome of as many frog species as we can in Papua New Guinea before the fungus comes. And then that way, when it comes, and scientists are saying it's not a matter of if, it's when will it arrive, that what we will have is basically like an IVF clinic of as much frog genome as we can, so that we can repopulate and breed frogs in captivity and then release them back into the wild once the population is stabilized from the effects of chytrid fungus. Only a few weeks ago, we actually released the first ever captive-born frogs in Papua New Guinea.
Wow.
Back into the wild. So that's, you know, it's pretty exciting, the stuff that we've been doing here. So in amongst the financial strain that we've been on, the stresses of COVID, the uncertainty of the future, I think, you know, we've tried to remain committed to what is our purpose here and you know, what is the goal and our vision and our mission. So it's been nice to be able to have a few of the small wins in amongst what's been a really tough year for us.
The Port Moresby Nature Park doing some really important work for the biodiversity in PNG. And that was Michelle McGeorge, the CEO of the park, speaking with me there.
The ABC's expanded FM network now reaches five major centres in Papua New Guinea.
On 101.9 FM.
You can now hear us in Port Moresby, Lae, Mount Hagen, Goroka and Arawa Bougainville.
On 101.9 FM.
Keep up to date with regional and international affairs, sports, lifestyle, cultural and environmental stories. ABC Radio Australia on 101.9 FM across PNG.
That is all for Pacific Beat this morning. But Talia Olatia will be along at 3 p.m. PNG time for the afternoon edition of Pacific Beat. Stay with us though on ABC Radio Australia to keep across all the latest news from around the region. And head over to our Facebook page. Just search ABC Radio Australia, where you'll find breaking news and you can get in on the conversation and let us know about what you think of all the stories that you've heard this morning. If you want to listen back to any of those stories, you can head over to our website. Just search ABC Pacific Beat into your preferred search engine and you'll be able to find us there. My name's Jordan Fennell. Thank you so much for your company this morning and have a happy Thursday.